welcoming. We got serious stuff to talk about. All right. Once again, welcome. Hope we get through everything. As Nolan brought up, my slideshows keep getting longer and longer. It's because we're getting more and more into the stuff I really like. All right. Once again, talking about different ways of seeing in learning to look about, learning to look at art, learning about art as kind of an analogy to a different way of knowing that Paul kind of brings up in a couple of different places. Here we have a passage from a couple weeks ago in Romans. He talks to them about speaking in human terms because of their natural limitations. This idea of looking at art is, in one sense, to maybe try to overcome some of those natural limitations, right? Of opening ourselves up, expanding kind of our horizons, and the goal being to create ourselves perhaps more receptive to the Spirit. So, when I asked several weeks ago, how would you define art? One of the answers that came up is, what isn't art? And that's very apropos to what we're looking at today. But then someone said making as opposed to doing. Very apropos as well to these artists. So we'll be focusing today on a couple artists, Robert Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns. Another thing that Nolan pointed out, you know, looking at a lot of art from old dead white guys, I apologize for that. I'm kind of following the standard somewhat art history, which is full of old dead white guys. But these guys are gay. Does that count for something? So, yeah. Check there.
That's art guys.
What's that?
That's mostly art guys, though.
Yeah. So, okay, we'll start with Robert Rauschenberg, born in 1925 and died in 2008. And when I heard that he had died, I was kind of sad that I never got to meet him. You know, his art, I was very intrigued and very inspired by his art. So I actually made a little piece in honor of him when he died. So I'm going to just kind of, since it's small and a lot of white on white, I thought I'd just pass it around and let people look at it there for themselves. Tried to do something that maybe is evocative of his style, if you can say he has a style. He kind of does, but he doesn't at the same time. So started off, he's always been very experimental. And interestingly enough, he was raised in the Church of Christ in Port Arthur, Texas. And originally aspired to be a Church of Christ preacher when he grew up. But then his home congregation preacher forbade him from going to a middle school dance, and he was like, well, forget this, I'm done with the religious thing, I guess. And then he became an artist. So you know, we have that phrase, you know, don't do this, it could lead to dancing. Well, if you don't dance, it could lead to some other things. So he experimented a lot with photography, and these pieces are actually made with his, at that time, wife. They're blueprint papers, and that are, I don't know how you make a blueprint, but I guess it's a photo exposing type process. And so they would lay out the paper, and that's his wife on the left, and that's him on the right, in a couple different poses where they would have parts of it covered and they would just have like a spotlight and lay down there and kind of spot it and expose it in different ways and kind of get some translucent effects. Worked early on with just wanting to explore different elements and aspects of art. So he made these what are known as elemental sculptures of just literally rocks and wood and rope, and he made some pieces that just focused on like clay and dirt. He actually had a painting that was dirt, and then he accidentally spilled some seed on it, so it started to grow grass, so then it became a grass painting. And apparently he actually had it hanging in a gallery one time, and he would go in and regularly and water it while it's hanging on the wall. But then eventually the grass died, and so that painting's no more. But he was also, interestingly enough, perhaps an aspect of the influence of his faithful mother, who was very much into treating everybody the same, whether you're a homeless person or a prince or, you know, doesn't matter. You treat people with love and acceptance. And in one sense, he kind of carries that on into materials in artwork of, you know, there's been this long history of art where there was only certain materials that art was made of, right? Sculpture, you either had marble that you carved in, or, you know, you may have a cast bronze. Painting was usually just confined to oil paints, especially at the time that he was becoming an artist. There were certain things where it's like, these are art materials and these are not. And he really kind of opened that up to where anything, literally anything, could be art. And so this white painting that you see there, you know, pictures don't do it justice, but it's painted with a kind of a shiny, glossy white, so that when it hangs, it actually picks up on a lot of reflections. And so it's not necessarily a white painting as it is a receptacle for reflections. And the work of art is really, in essence, whatever is around that's being kind of picked up in the painting, so to speak. So in one sense, the painting is nothing, but in another sense, the painting is everything all at once, right? Picking up on whatever environment that it's in. There was a sense, too, of, I think, breaking away from the past. So when he was starting out as an artist, right, the abstract expressionists, Jackson Pollock, Willem de Kooning, all those guys, Mark Rothko that we talked about last week. I mean, abstract painting was it. If you didn't do abstract painting, you know, you weren't really an artist, right? And so there was this conscious desire to get away from that and do something new. And so he actually had the idea of, literally, what if I erased one of their works? So he mustered up the courage. That involved a little bit of liquid courage as well. Went to Willem de Kooning, which is one of those artists that I didn't talk about last week. Went to his studio and explained the idea. He's like, hey, it can't just be a drawing in your style that I erase. It needs to be one of your works. And Willem de Kooning actually agreed. And so brought him in and started looking through some of his works on paper, and was kind of looking through one file that he had of them, and then apparently muttered to himself, no, it needs to be really difficult. So then he puts those away and he gets some other ones out that are, you know, a lot more intense materials. and starts looking through those. And then apparently he said, no, it needs to be something I'll miss. So it needs to be something that I actually really like, a work that, because, I mean, artists will do works on paper a lot of times, these drawings, and it's practice, it's sometimes planning out for larger works, but a lot of them are in one sense throwaway, right? They're kind of practice pieces in a sense. And Willem de Kooning, you know, caught on to the idea and realized, no, this needs to be something that I think is a good piece. And so he finally gave him one and took him, I think, a month and I don't know how many different types of erasers, but he literally erased the entire piece. I mean, if you can look closely, you'll still see some, you know, what just looks like kind of modulations here, but bits and pieces of, you know, kind of wax crayons or oil paint sticks that, you know, just didn't fully come out, but completely erased it and exhibited it. So, here is probably this is very much his style, so to speak, especially in the early works. So still very kind of abstract expressionist style in the sense of the mark making that he does with kind of the splatters and drips. But he starts to incorporate, thanks, Seth, starts to incorporate, like I said, anything and everything, right? Nothing was excluded from being an art material. And so images, he worked on different ways of transferring images. There's a way of like putting different types of solvent on a photograph, and then you can kind of rub it and the image will transfer to whatever, you know, paper or canvas that you're doing that on. And collaged materials also helps, you know, with this philosophy of art, this idea that anything can be an art when you're just starting out and you're poor and you can't afford art materials. Daily walks around the neighborhood and whatever you can find on the streets will work. And it, you know, it again, you know, we talked about the transition to abstraction, right? If the power of a work comes in really the interplay of forms and shapes and colors, right? Why do you need an object that you're depicting? You can just concentrate on just these relationships. Well, if it still aligns shapes, colors, do you need to actually make the shapes, or can you find something that has a shape that's intriguing or that the color effects are working for you? And so it's kind of this logical progression of really, you know, you take an idea about art or elements of art or, you know, parts of art, and just start questioning, why does it have to be that? Or if it is that, then can't I do that with different means? And so he very much kind of just opened up the idea of what art could be.
Mike?
Yes.
That last one, the one on the right, as soon as I saw that, I thought The Last Supper.
Oh, yeah. Very much like Da Vinci's thing. I mean, yeah, you have a lot of the activity right there in the middle, roughly divided into thirds, which Leonardo's Last Supper, you have, you know, groupings of the apostles in thirds. Yeah, very much, you know, his artwork plays a lot of the idea of associations. Right, we can see in these works a lot of different things. It's a lot more open to interpretation, And he starts going back to using titles for his work as opposed to numbers, which a lot of the abstract expressionists did. Not as a means of trying to explain the picture, but as another element, right? You have paint, you have these different materials, you have different objects, and now you have a word, and all of these different things, both visual and now language, linguistic, are all kind of juxtaposed and create meaning, but also subvert meaning, as a way of keeping things open and, you know, allowing the viewer's own experience to play into the interpretive process, so to speak. And so he really went full bore and started creating works that he called combines, which are part painting, part sculpture, right? Again, kind of in the classical sense, you have materials for sculpture, marble, bronze, maybe some wood carvings or things like that, but they're usually not painted. They're left kind of their natural color. You know, color and paint is for paintings, flat two-dimensional surfaces. And he kind of combined the two of those. So, and a lot of times he would have to kind of rehash pieces. I think this that middle panel that's kind of sticking out from that painting on the left, the narrow part, that might have been left over from one of his panels from the white paintings earlier. He would take those and kind of repaint on them and repurpose them. But it also becomes a different aspect of looking, right? Instead of looking at an object per se, he has areas where you look through. A lot of times there's holes where you can see the wall on the other side. There's different parts of the painting or sculpture that are somewhat translucent that you can see. And what's on this surface interacts with what's on the surface behind it. Started incorporating a lot of stuffed animals. There we go. One of his most famous combines probably is this piece called Monogram. He found this this stuffed goat in a, it was actually like an office supply store or something like that. I don't know, secondhand store, but went in and asked the guy, you know, how much for it. He kind of talked about it was sad that these animals were dead, and so he wanted to kind of give them an extended life. Different kind of life, I guess, as an art piece. But the guy said, I'll sell it to you for $35. He's like, well, I don't have $35. I have $15. Can I pay you $15 now and I'll come back and pay the rest? I don't know how long it took him to come back to pay the rest, but when he finally went back to pay the remaining $20, the shop was closed. And so he got it for just $15. But to kind of, well, first let's hear a little bit of his words. Any incentive to paint is as good as any other. There is no poor subject. I think that's in direct response to abstract expressionists, which felt they have to have these lofty, universal, human, existential subjects as the only true subject matter for an art. And he felt, no, it can be, you know, a lot more than that. Painting is always strongest when, in spite of composition, color, etc., it appears as a fact or an inevitability, as opposed to a souvenir or arrangement. Painting relates to both art and life. Neither can be made. I try to act in that gap between the two. That's kind of a famous phrase, that kind of a catchphrase that he has, that he works in the trying to bring life into art, and in essence, art into life, in a sense, because especially as he starts using different materials, right, it changes how you start looking at just everyday materials. You never really thought that maybe they can have an artistic use before, but once you see them as art, you know, I see stuff all the time. I was like, oh, I could use that for something. I have to really control myself not to just collect a lot of things. I don't do so well.
There are seasons.
Yes, exactly. So, these images are kind of jumbled together. Looking at kind of the artist's state of mind, and that this isn't just a bunch of stuff thrown together, that there is a lot of thought put behind it. That piece went through several different stages. So he had an original sketch where it was up on a painting and it was behind a ladder. And then you can see a picture of him in his studio with, it doesn't have the ladder, but it does have a canvas with the goat kind of perched on a shelf attached to the canvas there. And so he kind of had that for a while. Wasn't sure, it wasn't quite working, didn't know quite what to do with it. So then disassembled that. The background to that piece, he actually further reworked, and that became a painting of its own. He then got the idea of wrapping this tire around it. And then, again, one of these, this tall, skinny piece next to it was one of the panels from that old white painting that we showed, repurposed and painted on that. Had this for a little while, but he didn't really like the idea that this goat, to him, kind of seemed a beast of burden, like it was pulling the painting along. So he didn't quite like about that. But his friend Jasper Johns, which we'll talk about here in a little bit, suggested, well, what if you put the painting on the floor and give this goat like a pasture, in essence, to live in? And so that's how that came about. There's actually some videos of, you know, them installing this piece in museums, and it's kind of fascinating because it actually comes in pieces. So the goat is on a little cart that has casters on it, and I don't know if you can see, there's a slight shadow underneath the painting part. It's actually raised up off of the ground, so it's resting on the casters underneath the goat, and then they have the tire that they then put on the goat, and then the painting is in two panels that they have to put together and attach. So,
does he ever talk about metaphor, the use of metaphor in his work, or that's just left up to the observer?
Yeah. The question, he got the microphone after the question was
that. I just said metaphor. Does he approach that left up to the interpretation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a deliberate choice. I mean, I'm sure he has his own thoughts that go into it. But I know he also, similar to the abstract, you know, similar to a lot of artists, right? We may have some meaning or thoughts behind things, but we don't necessarily want to project those onto the viewer. So as much as he has maybe references that have some meaning to him, I think he also would deliberately put things in and arrange things to kind of subvert that, to fight against that. So it wasn't just, you know, one meaning. I think a lot of times when he's looking at works while he's making them, not only is he thinking about different metaphors, right, that these things can be associated with, but he's also fighting against those. He doesn't want it to be so clear that it's just kind of like you don't want to just go up to it and say, oh yeah, this is that, and then you've got it, right? It needs to have some complexity and some depth so that interpretations, they become more questions that are posed and left open for viewers to answer.
When I was looking at the tire, it's just the opposite. The white wall is on the tread,
mm.
as opposed to the tire sidewall itself.
Yeah.
I was thinking, I wonder what he's trying to, you know, get the observer to think about.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know how much of that was a conscious. I can very much imagine him playing with, you know, that reversal of white and black versus white wall, you know, tires. And I don't know if it was a particular thing that he was going for with that, or just playing with this idea of, you know, we normally think one way and see things one way. I'm going to present it in a different way just to kind of break that those mental patterns. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I think it's interesting, and I can't remember if it was last week or the week before, you talked about how people often ask you as an artist, how long did it take, right?
Mm.
That is a way that people think when looking at art. And I have found oftentimes it feels like people, the other question that they're going to ask is, well, what were you saying? They want to know, what were you saying?
And or what does it mean?
What does it mean? And it makes me think, you know, earlier we were talking about stalling, like making Michael take more time, so having lots of comments so he can get through all the slides. And the comment was made that there is somebody, maybe from this congregation, that used to, when people would say stuff during his class, you know, he would be like, those are some words. Or like, it didn't expand on the comments. And it made me think of a lot of artists that I've met through you that when asked that question, that's kind of their response of, when somebody says, oh, you meant this. And they're like, those are some words you could say about it. And I find artists that have been working for a long time and are more established tend to not answer,
mm-hmm.
tell me what this meant.
Yeah.
They're very reluctant to say the metaphor, but there always is, like, if an artist and an artist are talking, those metaphors will come out and the artist will share. But if they're just talking at large to people, it feels like they just kind of answer with those are some words you could say about this piece.
Yeah.
But they don't actually ever say. It's like the mysteries are hidden.
Yeah. And even with artists, I mean, they may talk in general terms about general ideas or philosophies behind stuff, perhaps a general approach to art. But a lot of times it's like shop talk. How did you make that? You know, how did you make that type of mark? Or, you know, things like that. It's a very different sort of conversation. But yeah, art, especially from this point on, and I think that's one of the thing that makes Rauschenberg in particular so pivotal, is art really becomes this form of questioning, right? Of there's this kind of received way of knowing, these learned ways of knowing, patterns of seeing and thinking, and art's purpose really becomes to try to break those down quite a bit and open it up to leave room for change, for growth, for different perspectives. So. Here's just a couple more examples. You know, this idea of metaphor, or even like sources. So this piece, Canyon, is very much steeped in some Greek mythology. I don't know the whole story, but there's a figure named Ganymede, I believe, who was a young, very attractive boy. And some versions of the story say that Zeus changed into an eagle and came down and abducted Ganymede, and took him back to be his cupbearer. Probably also some sexual activity involved in that position. But you know, we have a picture of a young boy there on the left kind of reaching up. That's actually a picture of Robert Rauschenberg's son at the time. And so you have this youth, you have this eagle, you know, so you have these associations, but it's not a strict illustration of that mythical scene per se, but you have these allusions that he taps into. I put the piece next to it here. They're separated very much in space and time. That was done in the 50s, late 50s, I think, maybe early 60s. This was done in 1981. But his son, Christopher Rauschenberg, actually lives in Portland. He runs a photography gallery downtown, Blue Sky Gallery. And when he was starting the gallery, he needed some startup funds. And so his dad kind of donated this piece to be sold to raise money, and the Portland Art Museum bought this piece to provide funds for his son to start up his photography gallery. So you can go to the Portland Art Museum. Last time I was there, I didn't see this piece. They must have taken it out of the rotation for a while, but sometimes you can see it. And his son still lives here, so. So here's an excerpt from an interview with him that I think raises some interesting points. One, the question, how do you achieve the immediacy in your work? Along with that, you know, that question of how long did it take you to make this, I think a good work doesn't necessarily reveal the time that it took. It just, like that quote earlier, that it just appears as a fact, as something that was inevitable. But just a different way of thinking about it, almost kind of a time element, you know, a sense of immediacy. He answers, by not trying to make up your mind before you're going to do it. It has to be immediate if you don't know what you're doing, right? It's not a planned out thing. And you take that chance, and it's very embarrassing. Sometimes you succeed, sometimes you don't. There's no security in it. When asked if he planned his pieces, he says, no, I have discipline. I work. And every day, don't know what I'm doing, but he felt if you're planning something, you have a responsibility to that plan. And so the process of his making art, I think, is something about it too. Sometimes it's hard to comment on these things because it's visual art. It's meant to be visual, not necessarily talked about. But I don't think any honest artist sets out to make art. You love art, you live art, you are art, you do art. But you're just doing something. You're doing what no one can stop you from doing. This inner necessity that artists have to just make stuff. But you also, so it doesn't have to be art, and that is your life, but you also can't make life. And so there's something in between there because you flirt with the idea that it is art. The definition of art would have to be about how much use you can make of it. Because if you try to separate the two, art can be very self-conscious, a blinding fact, but life doesn't really need it. So it's also another blinding fact. So, you know, sometimes you have to take artists' words with a grain of salt because sometimes they're deliberately trying to throw off the the interviewer, and we come up with our stock phrases to talk about our art or art in general, but you know there's still this sense of relating art to life, and art being a part of life, you know, life being reflected in art, that I don't know, for me just again kind of opens up some questions, you know, sticks a wedge in there to try to create space in just our normal thoughts and reactions and allow for something else to come about. Played around with the idea of these unique work of art and perhaps to counter, you know, some critics who say, oh, you're just kind of slapping this stuff haphazardly. So he made two versions of the exact same painting to show that even if, you know, with messy brushstrokes and drips and stuff, there is some element of control in that you can make two works that are almost identical, even in some of their kind of abstract, brushy sections. But there is kind of an element of chance. You know, not every single drip is exactly the same. Even the transfer process of transferring those images creates some variability there. But still this idea that even though it looks messy and kind of haphazard at times, it can be very controlled, like deliberately messy. You know, the thing with painting is you can always paint over it. So if something appears even haphazard, it was deliberate in that the artist left it there, right? That they decided not to paint over it or you know, smooth out any of the drips or anything like that. So so it is a very conscious, sometimes very intellectual process that comes from making, observing, feeling, thinking. His later works, similar in bringing different materials and imagery together, but really shifted towards the imagery when he learned to screen print. And sources could be anything from, you know, contemporary world events to old pieces of art, right? Take reproductions out of an art history textbook and blow it up and put the images into your own works. And again, you know, you still have an arrangement of colors, shapes, forms. Sometimes those forms are recognizable images. Sometimes they're pushed beyond being recognizable. And yeah, playing with this idea of metaphor, I think he wants it to look more like there is a metaphor behind it, but then kind of frustrate that process so it's not so easily grasped. And it's a reflection of the time and culture that he grew up, right? In the 50s and 60s, you start having, you know, material culture. You start having a lot more emphasis on advertising and, you know, the television and all these different, you know, images that were presented with every day. You know, this was the start of it. And so creating pieces that mimic what was going on in society in your artwork by just mashing together these different aspects of life and events and thoughts. So hello, there we go. He would work in often series. So he had a series that he called the Cabal American Zephyr series. So here's a couple of pieces from that, Ancient Incident and The Interloper Tries His Disguises. So again, you know, the titles are just another element. You have materials thrown together in kind of incongruous ways. You have images thrown together, and you have words layered on top of that with the titles. The titles probably are not designed to explain the painting or the pieces if they're more sculptural, but to just add another element to think about. A series called Scale, like the earlier one I showed from that's at the Portland Art Museum, was part of that Scale series. So here's a couple examples from that. Spread. A lot of these have interactive elements. Of course, you look at them in a museum and, you know, you're not allowed to touch the artwork, so you can't really interact with them anymore. But the doors on this whistle stop can open up. I think they're painted white on the other side, so you know, as you open it up, now you have different visual relationships that come about. I did see a piece at the Portland Art Museum. I don't know if they own it or if it was just on loan. Museums will often borrow pieces from collectors' collections and other museums to kind of keep their showings fresh. But it was one where it was like window shade, and it had like a clear or like a roller shade, and it had this clear kind of cellophane with different images on it. So if you actually raise and lower the shade, you would have these images that, you know, slide by each other, and you can create different different compositions in essence by doing that. All right, Jasper Johns was kind of his partner in crime when they were first starting out. He is still alive. There he is getting, what's the award called? Just Presidential Medal of
Freedom.
Medal of Freedom from Mr. Obama. Where Rauschenberg was kind of all over the place and exuberant, he was kind of the opposite. He was spent just hours sitting and thinking about his stuff. And started out with a series of pieces, different variations on the flag. And you can kind of tell the year a little bit, because if you look, there's only 48 stars. These were done before Alaska and Hawaii joined the Union. Targets. There is a target in that green one. It's hard to see. Maybe you can see it better up there then. Did a painting on canvas, of a canvas, by attaching a canvas to the canvas. But it's flipped over, so if both of them had images, you wouldn't be able to see them. There's a drawer, literally a drawer from a dresser. The face of it kind of stuck in there. Alphabets. That's just the alphabet over and over. Numbers. Either arranged in grids like the alphabet, or taking the numbers 0 through 9 and overlapping them, superimposing them. And so he, the flag for him it was just a way of designing, of create, having a ready-made composition that he didn't have to think about the arrangement, and he can kind of work on different levels as he talks about. Using the design of the American flag took care of a great deal for me because I didn't have to design it. So I went on to similar things like targets, things the mind already knows, and that gave me room to work on other levels. And this whole idea of making art as opposed to doing art. Making art is a way of doing something, right? Whatever you're thinking or feeling, you're left with what you do. The painting is what you've done. Some painters perhaps rely on particular emotions. I've taken different attitudes at different times, and that allows different kinds of actions. If you focus in one way, your actions will tend to be of one nature. If you focus another way, they will be different. I prefer to work that appears to come out of a changing focus, not just one relationship or even a number of them, but constantly changing and shifting relationships to things in terms of focus. There's some notes from his sketchbooks. One thing working one way, another thing working another way. One thing working different ways at different times. Take an object, do something to it. Do something else to it. Do something else to it. Take a canvas, put a mark on it. Put another mark on it. Put another mark on it. This very kind of worker-centered. This is the activity that I do. And I'm going to think of different ways, different approaches to do it. And so often plays around with the idea of making art itself, right? So you have these brushstrokes that are kind of abstract in terms of, you know, looking like abstract expressionism. But in one sense, it's also trying to look like it looks like abstract expressionism, right? It's like almost the brushstrokes are, I don't know how to phrase this, but the brushstrokes are almost images of brushstrokes, in a sense, right? He's kind of playing with that idea and making different marks. How do you make the marks on a painting? Well, sometimes you can get like rulers or straight edges and put the painting on there and then use those as like a compass to create different mark-making effects. The title of the piece is sometimes stenciled on and becomes an element of the piece itself, both visually and mentally. But it's all about looking at things differently. We've talked about one way of judging an artwork is how long it takes to make it. Another way, you can think in economic terms, right? How much is it worth? He and Robert Rauschenberg had a show with a new gallery in the same year. Rauschenberg was more well known. Met Jasper Johns. Jasper Johns saw Rauschenberg as, he is being an artist, and I need to stop pretending that I'm going to be an artist eventually and sometime in the future, and just start being an artist. And so, was very much kind of the lower man on the totem pole of this dynamic duo, but he ended up having his show first, and it almost sold out. Like every painting except for maybe three or four was sold. I think three or four of them actually purchased by the Museum of Modern Art. So like, right off the bat, he had some economic success. Rauschenberg's show a couple months later, I think only sold one piece. And I think the piece was bought by the gallery owner who was showing them. So it took him a couple more years to get his stride, but Jasper Johns kind of right off the bat, and people couldn't agree anything about his works. Some people said he created these plain objects to make them more visible. Others that he chose these objects to make them somewhat invisible, and they're just backdrops for the play of paint. And you know, nobody could really agree on what he was doing or what these were about, but everyone was affected by them in some way, right? It's just there's something about them that even if you can't explain, they either hit you or they don't, I guess. Basically, artists work out rather stupid kinds of impulses, and then the work is done. If you heard Kevin's sermon last week, him saying stupid, he would have gotten in trouble for that. After that, the work is used. In terms of comment, the work probably has it, some aspect which resembles language. But publicly, a work becomes not just intention, but the way it is used. So they were becoming very much aware of the audience and the observers may see something and think of artworks differently than they did. And so you're playing with meaning, you're opening things up, you're trying not to impose a certain interpretation on your audience, but also willing to, you make your work and then you just let it go out into the world and you can't control how people use it or abuse it. Yeah, we're kind of running out of time, so I think I just got a couple more pictures. I'll just kind of show some more sketchbook notes of just ideas to play around that end up becoming pieces, and then you play around with it in other images. He He did later on get towards some sense of self-expression that he fought early on. So four seasons has kind of four different types of self-portraits. All right, I want to get to a couple quotes here at the end. In terms of ways of seeing, right, just seeing things differently. Here, this first line is actually the title of a book about another artist, but I like the idea behind it. So, seeing is forgetting the name of the thing one sees. Right? So you're no longer seeing something and saying, oh, this is a chair. You're seeing it with new eyes without any preconceived notion of what it is, but you're looking at its features, its characteristics, its color, its shape, its context, meaning in society. So a different way of opening up. And a quote from Jasper Johns, to be a good artist, you have to give up everything, including the desire to be a good artist. And I would like to throw that out as, change the words a little bit, to be a good Christian, you have to give up everything, including the desire to be a good Christian. Let you chew on that for a while. All right, thank you very much.